Well, I wouldn't say that you're a strange one as much as I would say that you're a unique product with a unique product like Pandemic. So I don't know. It's okay to fangirl out a little bit. You get pretty good guests, you know what I mean? So how would you
The
not?
best guests. The
That's
best
the
guests.
you're I sit corrected. Not good guests, the best guests. Oh, look at you making rhymes around here. Look at you making rhymes. You ready to get started with this?
I'm ready. I'm a poet and don't even know it. You see, I had coffee today. I've been trying to do tea. Been trying to do tea and do my diligence with all of that. And yesterday I was like, you know what, caffeine, I love you so. And so I had some coffee and then I had some this morning. So get ready, because boy, woo, coffee.
Oh, watch out is what I'm hearing. And
Yes.
coffee, see, coffee is what I call people fuel, baby. It helps you get out of the gate to get over that starting line. I
I'm
think
way
that's a
over
good
the
thing,
starting
too.
line.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing. All
All
good. You're
right.
gonna get hyped up. Let's go with it. Let's go with it. Oh.
All right.
Welcome to another episode of Punk. I'm sorry. Me. Excuse our manners. I excuse mine as well. I forgot to say I already started recording. We got some of this behind the scenes banter that will bleed into this episode for sure today. It is another episode of the Punkdemic Podcast. It's your man 50 Grand, MC Johnny T, aka Thick Flair, joined by the one who books the bestest guestest, the hostess with the mostest, the queen of everything,
All the stuff.
Amazon CEO Pandemic. How goes it?
It goes. Like I said, I don't know. Well, I don't know how much of the pre-game they're gonna hear, but I got my coffee. The weather's not too hot, not too cold here, and I'm ready to go. I'm excited today. Super excited today. Super. Okay, go
Yes.
ahead. How are you?
As you, the way you describe today's guest, you, I'm good. I'm good. I'm good. You know, I know that you have described today's guest as a certifiable bass.
Yeah.
And so I can't wait to get him on the show. In just a couple of minutes, he is waiting out there in our digital lobby. But before we get started with that, we want to thank you guys for tuning in and listening to our podcast right here on the iHeartMedia Network. As well as any other platforms that you can find us, as well as at punkdemic.com, our website. Speaking of which, make sure you guys swing by that website while you're listening to some of these episodes. Swing by the shop and buy yourself a Punkdemic t-shirt or hoodie or beanie or anything else we can find to put a logo on. And support the podcast and also rep the movement. Make sure you go to punkdemic.com. We've got great prices out there. I mean, really, every day is a sale price over there at that website. So I guess I can just say we got plenty of items on sale. As a matter of fact, looking at the leading brand in our space, we generally are coming in at about 20 to 25% better prices than others. But really, is there anybody else that's truly in our space? Amazon? You know, it would be pretty far-fetched to really assume so. But meantime, in between time, swing by punkdemic.com. Get your stuff, punkdemic.com, punkdemic.com. Go get you your stuff. Without any further ado, we're going to bring in the man of the hour, the man, the myth, the legendary, the unstoppable, Mr. Unfunkwittable himself, Mr. Badass, if you will. Is who's going to be coming up in here in just a matter of moments. Go ahead and put our hands together for none other than the King of Mean. As he comes in smiling. There it is.
My
How are
wrestling
you
name,
doing, my friend?
my wrestling name is Black Death. So I see you got your WWF thing in the background.
He's a huge fan,
You
like
know,
Black Death. That was mine.
he calls himself Thick Flair.
I love
Johnny is a fan of anything with a curve on it, okay? And so
it.
we
But
go back
hey,
and
hey, obesity.
thank you all for having me. I appreciate it.
Man, it's
Thick
great to
Flair,
have you
though.
here this morning. It's great to You know,
no,
anything with a curve is good. You know, look, I like geometry. I don't really like the angles too much, but I'm all about the circumferences, if you will. Yes, yes, that's just kind of how it is. And you know what? I'm okay with it. It is who I am, and it is what I rock with. So that's just how it's gonna be.
All right.
You got this, well, Amazon.
I always got it.
Showtime, showtime.
See you later.
Oh, are we gonna start this already?
Yes. Good day, sir.
We starting already?
Good. See you later. My God, it's hard to find good help. You know what I mean? So I'm gonna get all my geeking out over you out of the way initially. It's not professional, but that's okay. Man, it's you. Hi.
It is me. C'est moi.
French today. We're doing French. Hey, you're in Italy. You're in Spain, speaking
I'm
French.
In Spain. I'm in Got Spain. It. But you know, at this point now, I'm like, I'll wake up at the start. And I'll start speaking any number of different languages because I'm forgetting where I am, you know. And I've got like these James Bond language skills, just enough to get myself in trouble in like at least 5 or 6 different countries, you know. So
when I talked to you, you were in Milan, yes?
Could have been in Milan. I mean, the last few weeks I've been. Where was I? I was just got back from Switzerland. I did a show with Mangine. We played support for Young Gods, which was really pretty phenomenal. It was sold out, but outside of it being sold out, it was pretty cool. And then a few weeks before that, I think I was out on the road with Buñuel, and we did, 4 or 5 shows in Italy? Or two shows. A show in Montpellier, a show in Cannes, and then a show in Milan, and I think Bologna. So we're trying to, you know, tour. The last thing we have to do is the west coast of the U.S. And that'll be it for Mansitude, which is the last record we just put out. So, and in between then, I just finished the vocals for what'll be the 5th record, which should come out late 2026.
5th record. So, okay. My gosh. First of all, your accents when you were pronouncing the locations is really good. Ah. I would have totally. So when I was younger, I was obsessed with going to the Louvre. I love art. And I was like, I'm going to France. I'm going to do the whole thing. Still never been, by the way.
I've never been to the Louvre either. So
really?
But I lived in New York until I was 18. I never went to the Statue of Liberty. It's just things you don't do, you know. I've been to Paris, 30, 40 times, but never been to, you know. I was in St. Petersburg, Russia, covering a mixed martial arts fight for German TV, and I didn't build in any time to go to the Hermitage. I mean, it was just stupid. These are things I want to actually do, but, you know, I'm down there fraternizing with the natives. So I never, and you can't get them to do these things. So, you know.
So what I was going to say is that, the more I dug into you, because there's a lot of you, the more I found, and it just kept going. So we only have a short period of time. It's definitely not enough to dive into all the things that you've done. Let's go back. You are in New York. What motivated you to get into writing? I noticed that writing seems to be your love. Or one of them. What are some of the influences or people or circumstances, whatever it is, that got you into writing?
Well, some would say, given that my stepfather is like an award-winning journalist as well, that it was him. But he hated the profession and never offered me any significant amounts of career counseling. And so for the majority of my life, my intent was to be a marine biologist. And, you know, I applied to Stanford, University of Michigan, University of Delaware, University of Miami. One of the reasons I wanted to go to Delaware was because they had just gotten a big slop of money in the biology department. And I figured, okay, I can make use of that. And Stanford was the first choice, and I got into Stanford. So I went, but it took maybe Chem 101 for me to kind of have a real come to. You know, I went to one of the most difficult schools in America for high school. And then I had to decide at Chem 101 at Stanford, which was taught by some barely apt or largely inept grad student. am I going to work this hard? Plus, a chemistry book was $350, and I was scholarship kid all the way. I said, am I going to work this hard for the next 4 years like I did in high school to get here, or do I want to do something else? So I dropped the idea of being a marine biologist. I didn't want to work for an oil company. I didn't want to, become a permanent student, get a PhD in it. So I just kept going to classes, and it wasn't until I met two professors. One was a linguistic professor, a professor of linguistics, and the other was a journalist, magazine writing guy. And they both said the same thing to me. I don't know what you're thinking about for a career, but you should do this. And then I realized a linguistics guy only was suggesting that I go into linguistics because he liked my writing. So Bill Rivers, who's passed on at this point, of course, I took his advice, but it wasn't much of an advice. I'd been writing for magazines since I was 14 years old. I think I sent my first query letter out to Esquire magazine. I still have it around. I must have been 10. So I pretty much started, as soon as I could write, I started to write stories and enjoyed it. And I was immune to criticism. So it wasn't like, I think maybe if I had sought out his counsel, my stepfather would have gone, oh yeah, you should do this. But I just, the important thing was for me to make a one-to-one connection between what I was thinking and how I expressed it on the page. And so, but I mean, also of course, being a large, muscle bound kind of teenager, nobody would take me seriously until I started writing. So I went to work for all the magazines in high school that there were. Bismarck E-line? They used to treat me like a wet food stamp, which amused me because I know I'm a better writer than everybody in here. So that's okay. That's fine. But I didn't until the third year of college or fourth year of college, senior year, even have any idea that somebody would actually pay me for doing what I really love to do. Or indeed, if that was a point in going to college in the first place. Right. So that had not been explained to me. All I knew is I had to get a job, afterward because I needed the money. And as luck would have it, I found two Germans who had been raised in Argentina.
Huh.
Yeah. Okay. But they had a Japanese head of human resources who had refused to hire black people. Okay. And they said, we're going to find a black person that cannot be denied. And they found me and they hired me over her objections. And of course, she ended up being one of my biggest champions later and, big supporter a discovery as to how wrong she was about her whole, race quota thing. So that was my first real job out of college, and it was at a defense magazine, strangely enough. So,
magazine. What kind of defense?
Like military defense.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, okay. my boss was we were reading about him in the newspaper, connected with Oliver North and Iran Contra Gate and all these other.
Wow, that's neat.
Yeah, it was heavy.
I have a little bit of a fascination with firearms, just a bit. Like, I'm an okay shot.
Yep.
For me, it was like this, it's necessary to learn. And that was
100%.
Woohoo! It was like, okay, you need to learn how to do this. I love it.
In the olden days, this is something that cultured people knew how to do. They knew how to defend themselves, right? So, Farai Chidea had me on her NPR show when she had an NPR show. I had spent 10 minutes trying to make fun of me for doing the fight book. I did the fight or everything you ever want to know about asking, but for you ask it for asking. And I was just like, look, this is, people who the downtrodden never had time to invest in this stuff. This is always a purview of the aristocrats. So it's not, they're not yahoos. I've been training since I was 10 years old, and I've met a whole lot of decent people in dojos, academies, fight schools, in the ring and in the cage, for the last 50 years. It's been a pretty phenomenal journey that way. So I don't consider it to be something that is unnecessary. And I've got all daughters and I have them all fighting. They all start fighting when they were 4, 5, and I got one is almost 30 now. And she's got my grandson and he trains. So it's something that it changes your outlook on life, and that also includes learning how to shoot guns and the whole bit. So
I think my buddy that taught me took my son to the range, I think, for his 16th birthday. So I waited until he was, seemed like he had a little sense, I used to tell him, you don't got the sense, God gave cabbage. I used to tell my son that all the time. So when I felt like he was mature enough, he learned. But I have four daughters, too. I was reading that about you.
Yep.
You're a girl dad.
Yeah, that's all I ever wanted. Yeah, you know, I have four sisters, right? So, the only men in my family are born like every 50 years or so. So it's my great uncle Sammy, who's passed on, me, and now my grandson. So it's pretty much every 50 years. All the men in the family have all married in. So, you know.
Well, I'm part of the fellow wet food stamp crew. So the way I learned about traveling to different places and going places, because we were poor.
Yep.
Or Poe, as you want to say, some people say, was through reading. So reading and writing became my love. And then from reading and writing, it fell into music and then so on and so forth. So that's why I was one of the only people, like, I'm going to Paris. And they'd be like, where is that type of shit? You know, stuff. Woohoo! Yeah. That's one. Right. And so how did you transition into writing, from writing to music?
I had a terrible summer job. And I say terrible, I don't mean bad. It was great if you wanted to game the system. I got a job at the New York City Department of Parks, and they said they loved me. So I did it 1 year, and they could tell I wasn't happy. It was like mobile recreation. We just show up in a park, and I had a crew of like 20 people. I lied about my age to get the job, so I had people working for me who were older than me, but I was organized and I was on time. And so we'd show up in a park and provide recreation. They go, well, how did you like that after summer was over? I said, I don't like people that much. It's just, you know. And they said, well, if you could do it again, I'd take an office job. So the next summer, they called me, and I was in California at that point, but I didn't have anything going on. This is between freshman and sophomore year. So as I go home to New York, because they kick you out, you don't have a place to live. And I said, like an office job. So they gave me an office job out in Queens. And it took me about 4 days to figure out that my job was covering for my drug-addled boss, who was covering for his alcohol-addicted boss. So it was a chip. I had to make believe they were all in the office all the time. And they would call in and say, did anybody call for me? No, okay. All right, I'll be in the field. I'll see you tomorrow. And they would never, I never saw anybody. I saw them once and never saw anybody for the rest of the summer, right?
The circle of life. So you're covering
for a 19-year-old, I was making, I came out of that summer with about $4,000 in my pocket, which was good money for a 19-year-old back then. So I said, I can't, you know, my mind is going to die here. So I did three things. I listened to William B. Williams every day, which make-believe ballroom time, the greatest hits of the 30s and 40s. And I put together what would be the first issue of the Birth of Tragedy magazine. Wow. And as I'm putting the magazine together in the office using the Xerox machine and a typewriter at the time, I came to this conclusion. I go, when I get back to California, I got to start a band. I got to do it. And as luck would have it, with inspiration for the magazine, I was in the subway at Union Square. And I walked over a magazine that said The Valium Addict. Yeah. And I go, that looked pretty cool. And I said, I'll probably see one some other place else. And I got two blocks away and I thought, you know, I'm never going to see that again. So I doubled back to the subway, grabbed it, and then had to run all the way to school so I wasn't late. And then I loved the magazine. It was great, like Xerox magazine. Years later, I found out it was put out by a guy who I'd become friends with, Richard Kern, the photographer and the filmmaker. And he goes, yeah, I did one for each drug. I did the heroin addict, the Valium addict. I go, man, that's why I'm doing the Birth of Tragedy. I love that magazine. So it was a circle of life type deal. So that summer, we're talking about the summer of 81 is when all that stuff happened. The magazine, the idea for the magazine, as well as the band. So
what was the band?
The band was Whipping Boy. I had been in one band before then, it was called Al and the X's, where I played sax badly. Which was my intent, to play sax badly. But the Whipping Boy, I didn't pick the name. The guitar player picked the name, but he explained it to me thusly. He said, you know, when a king had a prince, the people taking care of the prince couldn't beat the prince. So they would attach to the prince his best friend. And if the prince messed up, the best friend would get beaten. And the idea being that they were so close, it would hurt him as though it were him. And he would not act up in order to keep his friend from being beaten, which either happened or did not happen. And that friend was officially called a Whipping Boy. And I go, that explanation sold me on it, you know, because I was thinking some antebellum thing, you know, that I don't want to tie into that, but I liked his explanation, and so that became the band name.
So you played the sax badly, then we got Whipping Boy.
Correct.
What was next?
Did Whipping Boy for a long time. Put out a bunch more magazines, put out the Fear Power God spoken word compilation, which was one of the first big spoken word records. Harvey Kubernick and John Jerno were the only ones putting out spoken word records before that I heard, kind of in that same space. But I got, you know, Charles Manson, Anton LaVey, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Allen Ginsberg, you know, Lydia Lunch, Henry Rollins. I had a bunch of people on it and released it on white vinyl and cassette. And it's still out now. I sold the rights to Black House Records to put it out on CD. So you can still get it on CD now if you'd like.
That
happened. Whipping Boy, three records, three albums. One produced by Tom Mallon from the American Music Club, who also used to play with Chris Isaak. And then Klaus Floride from the Dead Kennedys did two and three, as well as a cut that we had on the Maximum Rock and Roll, Not So Quiet in the Western Front compilation from like 1982. So, but then all of those were stopped satisfying me as much as they might. And I had some pretty dire emotional circumstances, or at least, you know, as a young person likes to imagine that they're dire. And I said, you know, to leave a suicide note seems to me too totally ordinary. I got to do something. Okay, I'm going to kill myself, but I'm going to leave behind a suicide note via this record. And that record was Fuckfest, Oxbow's first record.
Wow. Okay.
And I played drums, bass, and I recorded a bunch of stuff. And I was like, I wanted to do a Prince treatment. It was going to be a solo record because it's a suicide note, right? And I realized I had two recording sessions in that it was arduous, you know, and I needed to talk to somebody who actually knew music to move ahead. And so I pulled in who later became Oxbow's guitar player and had been a guitar player in Whipping Boy, pulled him in to help with the record. And that's how we got the first record done. So, we sent it out and almost immediately got a bite from a record label in London that said, we want to license this from you. And we also want you to come over and play. And I go, whoa, I think I'd like to see London before I kill myself. And so it was that act of grace that actually kept me alive, because, you know, I wanted to go to London before I died. And then pretty soon the response was so great to that. Steve Gullick was there taking photos. He was one of the first guys to photograph Nirvana. So it was a big deal. We made NME Sounds, these big magazines. And I was like, hey, this is all right. When you finally start making music that you don't give a crap whether anybody likes it or not, magical things start to happen. So I chose, I guess, not to kill myself. Or like a friend of mine said, you're too handsome to kill yourself. You, you know? I was like, yeah, maybe you're right. I got nothing to complain about here. So
good looking people die all the time. However,
yeah.
You could use the phrase music saved my life and it would be like literal, because you just were like, well, I guess I'll stick around and keep making music.
I figured out that there are people who deserve to die a lot more than me, so I should stick around for a bit.
Backtrack, the spoken word. Mm. What was it called again, the album?
Fear, Power, God.
Three what words. Was that about? What?
The issues were all themed. So there was a fear issue, and that's the issue with Charles Manson in it. There was the power issue, and that I don't remember who was... maybe René Girard, the French philosopher, was on that one. And the God issue, of course, had Anton LaVey from the Church of Satan on the cover.
I know. So,
and then we had the love issue that had, you know, Kitten Natividad and Russ Meyer in it. So it was, you know, to take a standard topic and to kind of come at it from left field was the MO largely. So it's a great record. It's a great record. I still enjoy listening to it. So
how did you get them to do it? Like, I was thinking of doing this thing. Like, how did you?
Well, they had all been in the magazine. And so, you know, me perpetually being this kind of ambitious hustler and the man with a dream, I was like, hey, you know what I want to do? I want to put out a record, and you can just send me on a recording tape, record it at your house, whatever. You doing two things. I mean, you got 3 or 4 minutes to play with, do whatever you want. And they all sent in, you know, I still, Ginsberg singing, you know, all over Europe, people are saying, who knows? I mean, with, wow. You know, with his phlegmy cough in the background, or, you know, Ferlinghetti. I mean, it was a dream. And through those guys, I met like all the Beats who I'd wanted to meet before, Gregory Corso, you know, Peter Orlovsky. I met a lot of these people in both New York and San Francisco. And, Ken Kesey. I mean, it was great. It of course disabused me of my romantic notions of the era, because these were just, you know, at a certain point, they're just people you're dealing with. So the only one that kind of escaped my net was Bukowski, and he was like, "Look, you can come by, but can you bring some whiskey and a woman?" I said,
"Man, that sounds like him.
If I could bring whiskey and a woman, I wouldn't even be coming. I'd be somewhere having a party, you know, but whatever."
A lot of writers that are from where I was born in San Pedro, which.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's where he's from. So most writers, when I was in school, they just idolized him.
I didn't discover him until I got to California. I had no idea who he was. And I was like, fuck this guy. I didn't, excuse me, in my language, I was not interested in him at all. And somebody gave me Notes of a Dirty Old Man. And I go, this is a pretty phenomenal book. And I was sold. It's always curious to me that Nick Cave is not a fan. I found that very strange, but.
Huh, right? Yeah. But yeah, so if you didn't like Bukowski, if you weren't a fan and you were from where I was from and you were, you know, in the creative community, they were like, something's wrong with you. I didn't get crazy over him. I was like, okay. You know?
No, I mean, they're poets I like better. You know, I like Wallace Stevens better. You know, Nick Cave's own choice, I think he said it was John Berryman. Well, I like John Berryman too, but Bukowski has a niche that I think worked for him, certainly. So,
we're moving. You're from the East Coast. You mentioned you were in California. Where do you go after that? You're doing predominantly you're in New York, yes?
I came out to go to school, to college, and just stayed in California until August 26, where I decamped for Spain, you know. So I've been in California the whole time, hating it, but being in California the whole time. And from August of 1980 until August of 2025.
I didn't know that. Okay.
In California longer than I was in New York, you know. So,
how did you pick Spain to relocate to?
Well, Spain pretty much skipped through World War I, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War, and all the Gulf Wars. So, I figured from a geopolitical perspective, I was probably pretty safe. It's super close to Africa, Northern Africa. The Mediterranean Sea has no sharks in it. I built a house up in the hills. So I'm up in the hills. So even if there's a tsunami, you know, I think the only natural disaster I'm worried about is fire at this point. And I have a house that's pretty much a stone bunker. So befitting a New Yorker, kind of paranoid about survival. So I figure I have better chances of surviving here than probably anywhere else. And also, you know, I went on tour a few years ago. Buñuel's Killers Like Us had just come out. And I kept running into guys I knew from New York hardcore, right? And what are you doing here? And they're like, man, I've been here five. I can't afford to get old in America. And so by the fourth time I heard this, you know, and I started to really kind of examine, like, okay, I've had a house since I did that Bill Cosby movie, Leonard Part Six. I did two Bill Cosby's movie, Leonard Part Six, and the Fear, Power, God spoken word compilation. They were both, I made a lot of money from the Cosby movie. The movie was a total failure. I made a lot of money off the Fear, Power, God spoken word thing, and that was not a failure. I bought a house. But I followed my mother's dictum, which was to buy the best house in the worst neighborhood. So I bought the best house I could find in what was the murder capital of America back then in East Palo Alto. Wow. And it just appreciated. And then I bought a second one and then rolled that over into a third one on the expensive side of the tracks up there in Palo Alto, and then got another one and just kept rolling stuff over. So, but Spain was, I started to look online and say, if I sold my, you know, I get divorced and then I'm back to the hood. And I said, okay, but if I sold the house that I lived in which they were still running gun battles, I mean, as recently as May in front of my house, if I sell this house with the money I get from this house, what could I afford? And so for a 1,200 square foot house in California, I have an 8,000 square foot house in Spain.
Wow.
For the same price, you know, and, you know, I was clearly living in a neighborhood where there were gunfights. And here I'm, you know, up in the hills where, you know, you can't, you know, it's very nice. And outside of speaking Spanish, which then if you don't like it and you get proficient with the language, you have all of Central America, you have all of South America, you know, you can go to a lot of places that you don't can be if you don't want to stay here. But I did a lot of research and figured out that it's fine. This is exactly where I need to be.
It's safe to say you're a thinker. When you were getting ready to, when you're preparing to move, it seems like you thought about pretty much.
Well, because I hate to move. So, you know, it's not like I'm not one of those people who does it a lot. Like, clearly I disliked California the entirety of the time I was there. But I stayed because I had stuff that I was doing that it didn't really matter where I kept my stuff, you know? But mostly, I mean, I was going broke living in California. There's a point at which you have to leave or resign yourself to the fact that your money may expire before you do. In which case, what do you do? You know, nobody wants an 80-year-old anything. You know, I don't want an 80-year-old cook, an 80-year-old driver. I don't, you know, so what do you do?
You
leave or you lower your standard of living there. And I couldn't have done that much more than I already had. So
I'm right there now. So I understand. And it's getting more and more costly and expensive. Oh, I think we only rival New York as far as cost.
Yeah. San Jose, California is the most expensive place to live in America. To be comfortable in San Jose, they came out with a study. You have to make $274,000 a year to be comfortable.
Which I do not for the
record. Exactly. Right. So, yeah.
I like San Jose. I spend a lot of time up there and Oakland. Oakland.
Yep.
So I know about your music, give or take. So that's why I'm not diving into it so much.
Yep.
You've done some interviews of some people. Out of the however many that's been, who is probably your most interesting or your favorite person that you interviewed, and why?
I don't really like his comedy that much. I'm talking about Chris Rock.
I know.
But I found him to be a real interesting, and I don't even say from the interview that I came out of it liking him, but he was a real interesting person to talk to. And there were a lot of, I went to the set of a film. He did the Warren Beatty remake of Heaven Can Wait. I forget what his version was. And it was filming at the Apollo. So I flew in and wasted a couple hours of his time hanging out back with him in his trailer. And then when I wasn't the 2 hours I wasn't talking to him, I was, you know, talking to people on the set about him. Regina King, I think, was one of the people I talked to. But he was just a super interesting guy. And I don't mean in turn, like his affect was just so weird and so different from his public persona. It was really, I've never interviewed somebody where how they are when the camera is on is so far away from how they are when the camera is off. He was, I want to use the word without cheapening it, deep.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And that's not at all what I expected, you know, and thoughtful and almost deeply philosophical, which almost made me want to say, why is your comedy not better? You know, I mean, why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? The black people and the white people and that shit. That's just it's like 1950s Chitlin circuit stuff in my mind, man. I just I wasn't interested in it, you know. Especially since I don't think it was especially true to his experience, you know, based on what I know. I mean, we both grew up in you know, very similar sections in New York, but whatever. I found him to be an interesting guy. And nobody asked me that really. And he comes up when I think about his manner and the way he was in the interview. It was pretty much unlike anybody I've ever interviewed. And I've interviewed a lot of people, like, you know, like a lot of people. Yeah. So that was one of the ones that sticks in my head. And of course, my all time favorite interview was Billy Bob Thornton. That was fantastic.
No, that must have been fun.
It was absolutely. I love that guy. I will not I won't brook with any criticism of Billy Bob. None at all. He's a completely wild guy, up to and including his pitch perfect imitation of Fergie from Black Eyed Peas.
Oh no.
Complete with the dance, the whole dance and everything. Oh my God. He was great. He was really pretty great. So
isn't it neat when you can get that question that kind of pulls the person out of themselves a little bit more?
Yeah. Yeah,
or you
yeah,
catch
yeah.
them off guard and they go, I love that. Like, it's one of my favorite things to do.
Yeah. And, but he was just, he was weird and kind of watchful. And then he could see like, in other words, at a certain point, he could see that I was a gamer. Like, I wasn't somebody from, you know, Entertainment Tonight or right. People or Us magazine, that I was very definitely going for something different. And he was, I mean, the fact that he started life as a musician and I'm a musician, you know, I thought maybe that had something to do with it. He even gave me a present, you know, Solomon Burke had given him a t-shirt.
No.
It was a little too big for him, but he didn't give anything away. He was going to frame it, but he goes, I'm going to give it to you. And all of his staff was like, oh, in his dither, you know, like, oh, he gave you a shirt. He gave me Solomon Burke shirt, which I still have, which I, you know, I've not worn quite a lot. So, but when I do, it's like, yeah, just the shirt. So, yeah.
Funny. Do you keep things like that? Like, I now wish there's so many things I came across that I kept.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I mean, that's why I had to move to Spain. I had 170 boxes. And I've and from August to now, I've opened 162 of them. I have 8 boxes left of my stuff, but I'm finding weird stuff in there. Like, I'm looking through my stuff. I go, where the hell did I get this letter from John Wayne Gacy? I go, where did I get this other letter from? Oh yeah, that's right. We were associates for the last 6 months of his life, I guess. So. You know, he's a pretty good pen pal to have. I guess as long as you're not in his basement chained up, he's a pretty all right guy, you know. But I was trying to get an interview with him, and he was still hoping that this would help get him some sort of clemency. So I didn't think that was likely to happen, but I didn't get enough out of him to actually publish it other than his letters back and forth to me. So
because the name Punk is in the name mm-hmm. that I made up.
Yep.
The people assume that's all I do is sit and talk to punk rockers all day.
Yeah.
And I've had so many interesting people. I pretty much just talk to people that I find interesting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Punk or no punk. But it's funny because of the title. People are like, oh, that's all you do. I'm like, no, man, there's so many interesting people in the world.
Well, shit. I mean, I don't mind it. I got into punk in 1977 and have stayed, you know. I was there for the transition from punk to hardcore. And stayed. I mean, that frames a lot of my identity in my mind. I mean, a friend of mine from the early hardcore days in New York was like, hey, man, don't you think we've kind of sold out? I go, no, we're exactly the way it was supposed to have gone. Because, you know, I'll be in a meeting and somebody will say something I don't like. Or, you know, I mean, my last job was as a vice president at a big ad agency. And, you know, that I can feel that punk side of me coming out. Like,
yes.
I remember at some meeting telling some guy, I said, I think that idea is absolutely asinine. You know? And they're like, oh, you need to apologize to Joe. I go, I'm not going to do any such thing. He said he could take it. I gave it to him. He asked for the critique. That was my critique. It was an asinine idea. So,
No, it's I think a lot of people have a run in with it or a love from it. And some people stay in it. But I always tell people, if you don't grow and develop and get into new things, like, damn, you're boring. And that's not punk at all, right? To stay the same.
What is done? I remember seeing this fight with this guy, Josh Koscheck, who was like a bad boy, you know, wrestling. He was a heel, but it was in MMA, right? And he came out and the audience booed him. And I could see, I mean, I'd spent social time around the guy before down in San Jose. I could see he was actually hurt, like his feet. And I can't think of any better noise than 14,000 people booing me. It would just the punk rocker of me with such great delight. It would just be a really wonderful thing, you know. And to me, but it's just I got punk rock to credit with that, you know, because no matter how much you hate me, it's a drop in the ocean to how much I hate you. So this is a punk ethos as far as I can see. And it's stuck with me from 1977 to now. So
that's funny. That's I hate to tell everyone. That's when I was born. So I was born in 77.
I got you.
But yeah, it stays with you. There's a little part of it that never leaves you, no matter what environment you're in or what circles you're in. There's that little voice that at some point, see, I'm not supposed to say bad words. But you know what I'm saying? There's that voice that never leaves, and you're like,
yep.
If I just kick this thing over there, I wonder what would happen, right?
You know, and there were times when I was in L.A. when the DNC was having their convention in L.A. at one point, and I had dinner with Bill Clinton when he was president. And it was a small dinner. It was like me and Bill and like three other journalists. So it was a small dinner. And I'm thinking the whole time, it's like, you know, how many records could I sell if I just wheeled around and punched this dude in the face?
Right, like random crazy, like, so that goes back to that. And so I pretty much, they go, well, people always ask me, well, what do you do? Like, who do you talk to or what kind? And I have to think about it. I'm like, whoever I want to.
Okay, well, how did you find me?
Well, because your music, the band.
Yep.
I get a lot of, you know, what do they call it? The algorithm will send you more things. Uh-huh. And you're not new. You've been around for a minute, and I'm not new. I've been around for a minute. So I've seen you. I just didn't approach you for a while. I just was like, what is interesting about this guy? And then the more I was watching you, because it's been a couple of years, I think Punkdemic is 3 years in. Mm-hmm. The podcast is over a year in. I'm like every time you posted something, it was completely different about something totally different. Like the one with you and your boxers.
Yeah, yeah.
I was just scrolling. I'm like, Herb, what is he doing? And so now I'm deep diving. So I'm like, okay, one day when I feel like I'm a little more comfortable, because I hate the camera, the camera. I did writing. I did a little journalism. I don't like the camera. And so once I got comfortable, I was like, okay, I might hit him up because this guy's just doing too damn much. I can see.
Yeah. Yeah. They were going to put me on the cover of the, I think the SF Weekly, or the big SF Weekly, not the Bay Guardian, which is one of those weekly papers that used to be a big deal in cities around. And one guy was so aggressively against it, so much so that I think I must have done something to him that I don't remember. And the writer who did the piece was this woman, Mary Spacuzza, and she just like waited for him to finish at a meeting and just started to read off like listicle style the accolades, you know. And by the time they got to the 10th one, which was, I think we had just been at the Grammys that year, Joe Ciccarelli had been nominated for producing us and Kurt Elling. And the guy was like, okay, all right. But they ended up screwing me anyway, because they said, hey, we want to try this new photo technique during the photo shoot. And I go, I'm not about new. He goes, no, we want to stand you behind this piece of plexiglass. So it's like frosted glass. So you just see the shadow of you looming. I go, I don't want to do this. I know, because I'm an editorial guy. I know what's going to happen. He goes, let me just take one. I said, okay. Oh, His name, Paul Trapani. I'll let you take one. So he takes that one. And of course, that was the one that they had dog walkers on the cover of their publication, and they couldn't have me be full face on the front of the publication. And I was like, okay, score one for that hater. I don't know maybe I slept with his partner. I don't know. Who knows what happened, but that's what happened. So whatever. I'm happy for the press, and I, you know, could sell a few books off of it and a few records off of it. But that was dirty media pool, I thought, you know.
So there's something that they talk about a lot now called imposter syndrome.
Yeah, I've heard
this. Are you familiar?
Of course.
Did you go through that as you were progressing from?
Never at all. Not for a single bit. Which is, somebody once said, your insanely high level of self-confidence is the thing I worry most about you. It's going to get you killed. And I was like, you might be right about that. They asked me, you know, because I've done TV shows and TV commercials and movies. And this one TV commercial, it was like a James Bond theme. So they picked me to do it. And I was playing, you know, the bad guy. And they like said, okay, can you drive a boat? I go, yeah, because I can. You know, and they said, okay, can you drive a boat on the river? I go, river boating is not the, yeah, sure. And they, can you drive a boat between rocks on a rapid? I go, a powerboat? Nobody who is a powerboat will let you take it down the rapids with their rocks, okay? But I was like, you know, I know how much they pay for commercials. I did one for Gus Van Sant, 2 days for a commercial, made over $120,000. So yeah, I'm in. I can write. And finally, they had a licensed stunt, like some serious insurance people come in, lawyers and licensed stunt people, and they looked at the shoot and they go, absolutely no wiki. Can you guys do this? Do something else. It's completely crazy. But that insane level of confidence, it's like, well, I did a song for some other band, a band from Brussels, and I called it A Thousand Ways to Say Yes. I'm not saying no to too much. You know, I mean, I just played the show in France where there was a bona fide death threat against me. It was like, well, you're not going to stop me? No, it's not going to happen, you know. So
I think that's how I progressed from wherever it is I came from to doing this. And it's so funny because people are like, part of me is saying, this isn't a big deal what you're doing, right?
Yep. Yep.
My other half is saying, yes, it is, because you wouldn't even go on Instagram Live last year. You hated cameras that much. So I know where I've progressed.
Yep.
But isn't it interesting? For sometimes for me, it's I'm doing things and I don't say no. I just go, okay, well, can you do this? Well, even if I can't do it, I say I can sometimes. And I,
hey, what's the, you know, what did we, I mean, you know, at one point, Bukowski this came up late, later in life to go back to him, had slept with a man. And then he was like, I don't remember sleeping with him. I was drunk, but I woke up and he was in my bed. He's like, hey, look, look, look. He goes, people make such a big deal out of male homosexuality. I think they just need to relax about all that. So this is Bukowski's life. And I think, like, you know, all the things I've done, the TV commercials, TV shows, interviews, I mean, fear doesn't. I remember the first editorial director I had that gave me a major assignment was to interview Samuel Jackson. And she came into my office and she said, hey, do you know any writers who would be good to interview Samuel Jackson for the premier issue of this new magazine? I was like, yeah, let me think about it. And so she leaves my office and I was like, that was weird. Because I guess if she wanted me to do it, she would have asked me to do it. She's not going to ask me to do it. So is she seeing how deep my Rolodex is, whether I got. And I go, I can't think of anybody who would be better at doing it than me. So I get up, I go in her office, I go, hey, Abby. She's like, yeah. I go, you know, I'm the best person to do this. If there's a reason you don't want me, she goes, I was waiting for you to say that. So I was like, all right. Yeah, I say yes to everything. There's not much, you know, I'm not a fool. There's got to be a paycheck involved. My favorite question is always, what's the budget? But the budget doesn't always have to be as high if it gives me, you know, a key to a non-duplicative experience, something new that I haven't done before. Budget is maybe not that big of an issue. So,
yeah. And so I watched you and then I go, well, okay. I had to feel like a certain level of comfortability with myself.
Yeah.
Because again, the one word I thought of when I talked to you was impressive. I was like, ooh. Yeah. And it's not like you're on the big screen every day or you're what someone else would deem a celebrity, but you were to me. And I was like, wow, this is
well, that's
really
good
neat.
Because people, I think they feel some aspect of that. And then the pushback is this weird kind of hostility, but I don't, you know, I'm sort of immune to that. There are half a dozen reasons not to like me and what I do. And if you pick any two or three, and I'm cool with that. I don't expect to be loved by billions. You know, I'm not Margarine. No. Right. Or Justin Bieber. So, you know, whatever, pick and choose your poison. There's other stuff to listen to other than anything I have to do with, but I like what I do. So there's that at least.
So let's talk music a little bit. What are you doing right now? Right now, touring, new music, recording.
I just did the Mangin show in Basel, Switzerland for Young Gods. And that was so successful that they want to take us for 2 days, some festivals in March. March, I think 15th, 16th, and 17th up in Scandinavia somewhere. But before then, we have Boonwell shows. I can't divulge, maybe in February, definitely in May. And then even before then, January 17th, I'm going to be in Dublin, Ireland, doing book stuff. So I do, you know, I was just in Austin doing some books, Austin, Texas, doing some book stuff. And that's something I like. If I can do it on the same day, the afternoon of a show I'm playing that night, I'm fine doing that. Or I can do a book tour just with me and a box of books, even though that's super isolating. It's weird. It's weird to do. Because when you roll into town in a band, you're talking to each other, right? So you're not so, you know, you get in, you become this kind of insulated unit. And, you know, people want to talk to you in a new town. You're like, yeah, because I'm going to be gone tonight. I'll be, you know, to someone. But when you do a book tour and it's just you in a car with books, you pull into town, you're pretty much ready to, you know, to socialize. You need some basic human contact. So it's always an interesting. The last book tour I did, I took my youngest daughter with me, and that was great. That was really cool.
That's neat.
Yeah. She helped me sell a lot of, I think I sold more books on that tour than ever because she was doing my merch table, you know.
And she's
she
adorable. Like,
she's 4 years old. She was 4 years old then. So, you know, so, and then she came with me to the Mandarin show, and it was her first show because book shows are during the day. So it doesn't mess with the bedtime, but the rock shows are at night. So I said, kid, there's no choice, you know. You got to come with me on this one. There's no way to not do it. So she said, okay, I'm excited. But then she slept through because we went on it. The doors opened at 8 and we went on at 9 and she just couldn't hang. She was sleeping there on the couch and the, you know,
how old is she? Table.
She's
how
5
is
now.
She's
5 now. Yeah. So my oldest is my oldest is almost 29, 30. And then the youngest is 5. So a spread.
Oh, you sure did. Like, so my oldest is 28 and my youngest is 21 and just started college.
Oh, okay. So you couldn't pay
me $1 million to do it now. Like, there's no, listen, if it comes, I'm single. I'm dating now, but whatever. When they mentioned doing that again, I was like, can we get like a puppy or like a goldfish or, because I did it. I had 4 daughters. I have a set of twins.
Yeah.
They made me really appreciate it and not want to do it ever again. Like, I was like,
yeah, it's like a tattoo. Sometimes you forget how tough it was, but you know, the calculation, of course, too, is always the person you have the kids with, too. So even if you're an old hand at it, if they're new at it, it's going to be rough going for somebody. So yeah, it's a weird thing. But somebody asked me the other day on another show if I was a nihilist, and I goes, my days of being a nihilist stop when I decided I wasn't going to get a vasectomy because I knew that meant I would have kids. So, I sure enough did.
Yeah. Starting, let's see, 5. So, wow. Yes. You know, not for maybe for $1 million. Maybe.
No. It's a whole nother life at this point now. For me, given my age, I'm done. I'm done with kids. I mean, I'm not having a vasectomy because I, you know, listen, scalpels and my junk don't seem to be things that I can't see voluntarily. Everybody I know who's had one goes, I didn't hurt at all. And then they give me a look like I'm lying. So no, I'm all right.
Well, you're not done. She's 5. Like, you're just.
Yeah, exactly.
5.
Exactly.
You're at the beginning almost.
Yeah, my gosh. So
new
and
music.
And I've had enough surgery actually the last couple of years to, like, my quotient is, you know.
You're all good.
I'm 7 days a week with jujitsu under normal circumstances when I'm not doing shows. So I'm getting beaten up by, you know, 25-year-olds. Well, I'm not getting beaten up by 25-year-olds.
I was going to say, that's a lie. That's a
bold but I'm fighting 25-year-olds, you know. So even though I clowned some guy the other day because I want to make sure nobody's going easy on me because I'm older. And it turns out this guy is a phenom world champion. And I was clowning it. I didn't recognize him. You know, I was kind of clowning him before he rolled. And it to his credit, he was very gracious in dispatching me.
I was going to say, how did that go? Yeah.
It could have been a lot worse. And I was like, oh, man. But, you know, that's my brand. That's my brand. So
for your music fans, what are you doing? Anything new coming up? Recording anything new?
Yeah, of course. Constantly. I just put the finishing touches on 2 records worth of Buñuel material that'll come out in September. I did Bomb a Little Joy, which is Christian McKenna from Translation Lost Records. Justin Broderick produced some of the stuff on there. Some of the guys from Keel Hall. Bomb a Little Joy is the record I'm super excited about. Really different for me and really different for almost everybody on that record. And that went on sale December 5th. So that's out there. Mandarin, which is an EP that's out called 101 Atomic Terms and What They Mean. You know, it's got us a couple of gigs now with Young Gods. That's pretty fun. So Bomb a Little Joy, you know, Buñuel, Mandarin. But the thing that has been getting a lot of ink and press lately has been Eugene Sings, which is a record label in Atlanta, Georgia. It decided they wanted to do a covers record with me singing songs from the American Songbook. And what I thought would be why this would be worthwhile is because I hated the idea of doing them in a snarky kind of distanced way. Like, I wanted to do them like Al Jolson. They came up with a, he's a weird guy to pick for this, but he, they came up with a song, they go, that even Jolson won't be able to sell, right? Because he was known as this master salesman. And his song is called Sunny Boy. And they said he won't, and he sang that song and everybody was crying. They heard it and they were just sobbing. And I go, that 100% commitment that you want to, I go, that's kind of how I want to do the standards record. So that this first one is out now. I Gotta Be Me. And it's, I mean, it's, I enjoy it. Full orchestration. And yeah, wow. I think they got the guy from Oasis, the orchestra guy from Oasis came and did some of the orchestration on it. So it's a pretty cool project.
I see, Johnny, you've popped in. What?
The worst part of the party is when it has to come to an end.
Man, there you go.
That's like the worst part. Man, I used to hate hearing the DJs at the club say, man, you ain't got to go home, but you
can't stay here. Yeah. I used to bounce for a long time at clubs, and I would love that part of the evening because that meant finally I could go home.
Yeah. You know, I spent my senior year in college as a bouncer as well, too. And so
where?
Yeah. I went to Cal State Fullerton.
So in Fullerton.
So there was a pub across the street from the school. So it was the one that everybody went to on Thursday nights. And that was the best part of those shifts. It's different as a patron, but
yeah. Oh, yeah, it's permanently affected. It's permanently affected how I view night when I go out. If I go out to a nightclub, it's completely framed from the perspective of a bouncer, man. And half the time I end up talking to the bouncers, like just talking shop out in front and not even doing club stuff like drinking or hanging out with friends because it's just, it got in my blood. I did it for about 5 years. I enjoyed it.
Man, much respect, man. I was done in like two. I mean, it served its purpose. It was cool. You were within your legal rights if you ever had to get physical. So if you were ever looking for a reason, you didn't really have to look too far. So I was,
you weren't, it was all right getting,
for me, but
you weren't some, getting physical. Ways, it was a,
Oh yeah, man.
Some of my WWE in action, I had a chance to put some people to sleep.
Didn't put nobody to sleep.
When people start drinking well beyond their limits, well beyond their limits, you gotta, you'd be surprised at the horror that you see night after night. It's ridiculous what people do to themselves. So anyway.
Dude, they walk in looking like $1 million and it's going to be the best time of their life. And they walk out looking like they've been drained of any dignity.
I tell you, the most horrible thing that happened to me, this guy vomited all over, fell down, was rolling around in his vomit, trying to stand up. And my boss goes, get him out of here. And I was like, oh, man, I'm like germophobic. So I took his shirt. And I held his shirt. I held him up like this. And I was like, please don't fall back into me. Just as I walk him out to the front. So I go, just go to your future, man.
Be free.
Be disgusting. Disgusting.
Oh, so. Nasty. Man. Yeah. Well, you know, you earned your angel wings on that one and all of the success that's followed you all the way through beyond that. Let the people know how they can connect with you, whether that's a website, your handles for any of your socials.
Mr. Sleep 3, Mr. Sleep and the number 3 on Instagram, Eugene S. Robinson on Facebook. I'm still on Twitter too, at Eugene S. Robinson. Excuse me, on Twitter, the Twitter machine, I refuse to call it X, so screw that. I think those are the ways pretty much that people are getting a hold of me if they need to.
The Substack
Twitter, which is called "Look What You Made Me Do," well before Taylor Swift lifted my title, by the way. So,
that Twitter rebrand to X is probably the most terribly executed and flawed experiment. I don't think I hear anybody refer to it as X. Everybody still calls it Twitter.
Yeah, it's just, he's a ridiculous man. My old bass player worked for him for 6 years, and he said he actually started to like the guy toward the end, but No. I mean, I'm there because for my podcast, that's where people used to find out about me there. But I find the guy completely repellent. So
I was going to say, I only hope to be. Go ahead, JT.
No, you only hope to be.
I only hope to be interesting enough for you to want to ask me questions one day, Eugene.
I was that asking you questions. That is my new that's goal. I found out about you, the number of kids that you have, whether you're single, that you're from San Pedro, how old you are. I'm a journalist in my blood.
Yeah, do you take notes too? I'm working on it. I'm going to do something wild just to get on your podcast. I don't know what it is. Johnny, get ready. It's going down. I'm going to do something. You're going to be like, all right. I'm calling her now. She's doing too much.
Recognize this lady.
Yeah.
Recognize this woman.
I've done some things. I've done some things. A couple things. None of which I can say on here, apparently, yes, because now we're affiliated with.
Well.
Yeah. So was my old company.
Because we're doing some different things.
Ozzy had signed a big deal with iHeartRadio. And then, of course, my ex-boss, now convicted felon, Carlos Watson, pulled down the whole house of cards on us, but at least it got me into the New York Times. So there is that, right?
That's
so
neat. Yeah. All right, JT, wrap us up because we're at the, we hit an hour easily. He doesn't know it yet, but me and Eugene are now best friends because I got questions. We're going to be, he's going to be like, please tell her to leave me the hell. I said, hell, leave
I'll me answer. Alone. Anything you want to ask, I'll answer honestly. So
we're BFFs now. You don't even know what's going down. All right, wrap
and
us
that
up.
Feels like the perfect place to wrap this episode. Thank you guys for tuning in to another episode of the Punkdemic Podcast, available exclusively, or not really exclusively, but inclusively at punkdemic.com, all of our merchandise, and on iHeart. We're out of here until next time. Like last year, we are out of here. At the end of the day, it's night. Rise like yeast. Be kind to your mind and one another. All of that stuff. All right.
Terrible. It's really, really bad. Time.
Like last year, we're out of here. Peace. Adios. Talk to John Cena on the retirement. There it is. Later.
Bye. Oh my God.